Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Monday, the 15th of July, these are our main stories. President Trump has been accused of racism after saying that four Democratic congresswomen, none of them white, should go back to where they came from. French police have clashed with anti-government demonstrators after the Bastille Day celebrations in Paris. And American Airlines say they'll have to cancel flights until November as a result of the grounding of Boeing 737 MAX passenger jets. Also in this podcast,
an absolutely epic final of enormous proportions. Two players going toe-to-toe, fantastic tennis.
Novak Djokovic has beaten Roger Federer at Wimbledon in a battle lasting five sets and almost 5 hours. President Trump has been accused of racism after suggesting that a group of left-wing ethnic minority congresswomen should go back to where they came from. On Twitter, the president said they should fix the catastrophic governments in their countries of origin instead of criticising the US. Three of the congresswomen were born in the US, while another came to the country as a young child. The group includes Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose ancestry is Puerto Rican, the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, and the African-American Ayanna Pressley. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, has called Mr. Trump's comments xenophobic and divisive. I heard more about President Trump's tweets from our correspondent, David Willis, in Washington.
Well, in these tweets, a series of tweets, Donald Trump says that these progressive Democratic congresswomen, as he puts it, who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, now loudly and viciously are telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, as he puts it, how our government is to be run. And the president goes on, why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came? Then come back and show us how it's done.
And it was that go back comment that really caused the most criticism, wasn't it?
It was, and that has merited the most response on Twitter. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying, Mr. President, the country I come from, in quotes, and the country we all swear to is the United States. Ayanna Pressley put it, we're not going anywhere. And Rashida Tlaib calls for the president to be impeached. But I think it's obviously difficult because this is incorrect. Three of these four women were actually born here, and Ilhan Omar was born in Somalia but moved to the United States as a child.
These congresswomen weren't actually named by him in his tweets, but they very much feel that they are the target, obviously, and they have been the focus of quite a lot of criticism, haven't they?
They have, and they are controversial women of colour and social media savvy, and that has brought them into conflict with the leadership of their party, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, particularly in the House of Representatives, particularly over immigration and the detention of people at the border, which is proving a very difficult issue for the Democrats right now.
That was David Willis in Washington. Police in Paris fired tear gas on Sunday at protesters on the Champs-Élysées shortly after France's annual Bastille Day military parade. Earlier, they booed and whistled as President Macron passed by. There had been calls on social media for the yellow vest protesters to use the occasion to renew their demonstrations against the president. Even though the protesters were banned from the area, it seems hundreds turned up. To assess their current strength, Lise Doucette spoke to our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield and asked him about the Bastille Day parade, which began as planned.
It was a very successful occasion. The high point was the arrival of this extraordinary scene of a man, flying man basically, a man on a kind of hover apparatus, which meant that he basically flies carrying a gun. I mean, it was the most extraordinary sight. So it all, that all went very well. One thing that went wrong as far as President Macron was concerned was that he was booed at one point as he came down the Champs-Élysées by a group of, it turns out, the old Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vest protesters. And then afterwards, there were these scenes along the Champs-Élysées when the military had disappeared and crowds, ordinary people were reclaiming the space, if you like. That was when these groups of protesters, who may or may not have been Gilets Jaunes because they weren't wearing the Yellow Vests, if they had worn the Yellow Vest, they'd have been summarily evicted by the police. No one was wearing a Yellow Vest. And we saw again a kind of reprise of some of the scenes that we saw, well, not for some months now, really, with barricades being set up, tear gas being fired, fires being set. It didn't last very long, to be honest with you. The police were ready, and we knew they were ready. I mean, this is quite near the BBC office, and I saw at the end of last week that there were shops that were barricading themselves because they were worried about today.
The Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, had actually been banned from the area. Is it just for today?
That's been almost a sort of regular feature of weekends since March, April, when the last significant Gilets Jaunes demonstrations took place. But, I mean, it was set in the rules then that the Gilets Jaunes would not be allowed near the Champs-Élysées on days when it looked like there might be a demonstration. There were fears that there would be some kind of protest today. So, yes, they were not allowed near the Champs-Élysées today. And that was why three of their historic leaders, I say historic leaders as if, but it only goes back a few months, but I mean, the ones that are known, three of their leaders were arrested today on or near the Champs-Élysées and on the grounds of organising an illegal demonstration. They were later released, but it just goes to show that the authorities were very much alive to the threat of the aftermath of the military parade becoming, a bit of a showcase for the Gilets Jaunes again, who, let us remember, are feeling very much on the defensive. I mean, the Gilets Jaunes have kind of disappeared from the national conscience over the last few months. The last big demonstration was March, and since then we've barely heard a peep. The European elections went by, they barely registered. So inside the movement there is a real sort of crisis, a questioning what on earth did they do next. And this, I suppose, was a chance to register again on the national radar. But I mean, it was very, very small numbers we're talking about here.
That was Hugh Schofield in Paris. American Airlines has announced it's having to extend flight cancellations for a fourth time due to the continuing grounding of Boeing 737 MAX passenger jets. David Bamford reports.
American Airlines said about 115 daily flights will now remain cancelled until early November. This is due to a shortage of aircraft. Aviation authorities around the world grounded fleets of 737 MAX passenger planes in March after two crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia killed a total of almost 350 people. And last month, the US authorities, the FAA, said they had uncovered an additional flaw that Boeing said would take until at least September to fix.
That was David Bamford. Britain, France and Germany have come together to appeal for dialogue as tensions escalate between the United States and Iran. In a joint statement, the Europeans said all involved needed to pause and consider the consequences of their actions. Relations between Washington and Tehran worsened dramatically after President Trump abandoned the international nuclear agreement last year and imposed sweeping sanctions on Iran. In retaliation, the Iranians recently began breaching provisions in the accord that curbed their nuclear program. The European statement also follows a bruising week in Britain's relations with the Trump administration and the publication of more leaked documents from Sir Kim Darroch before he resigned as the UK's ambassador in Washington. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Robbins.
Britain, France and Germany are making a strongly worded intervention to try to prevent the crisis in relations with Iran deteriorating into something far worse, armed conflict. The focus of their joint statement is on the need to try to preserve the 2015 nuclear deal which President Trump abandoned in favour of increased sanctions against Iran. It's a deal which Iran now says it is breaching because it is not delivering the promised economic benefits. So Theresa May, Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel say, we're concerned by the risk that the nuclear agreement further unravels under the strain of sanctions imposed by the United States and following Iran's decision to no longer implement several of the central provisions of the agreement. It's likely to infuriate the White House, seeming to equate aspects of United States hardline policies with those of Iran. And it comes just as publication of the latest material from the leaks of Sir Kim Darroch's previously secret assessments of the Trump administration show the ambassador in May last year calling the president's determination to pull out of the nuclear deal an act of diplomatic vandalism.
That was James Robbins. Well, as tensions rise between Tehran, the United States and its allies, the BBC has been given rare access to Iran. Iranians remain furious that President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal last year and then imposed crushing sanctions on the country. Our correspondent Martin Patience has been in Tehran and the holy city of Qom, talking to Iranians about the escalating crisis. While he was in the country, recording access was controlled. As with all foreign media, the team were accompanied by a government representative at all times.
We're in a holy shrine in the city of Qom, the conservative heart of Iran. The shrine is decorated by spectacular yellow and turquoise mosaics. There's a large golden dome in front of me. The hardliners here argued that Iran should never have negotiated with America in the first place, that Washington simply couldn't be trusted. And when Donald Trump pulled out of the deal, their position was strengthened.
What's your name, sir?
Ali Reza Fander. I'm a theological student.
What do you make of the current situation with America and Donald Trump? Are you worried?
In my idea, after the crone, am I right?
After the drone was shot.
Yeah. I think that the history is divided before this and after that. Before this, Western media and even some persons in Iran, they suppose that this is just propagation, it is bluff, I don't know what
does
it
bluff, mean. Yeah, bluff. Iran is not going to do anything.
Yeah, I think this moment is delicious. It was a very nice historical moment for us as an Iranian.
Do you think Iran should negotiate again with America?
Of course no. But how can you trust him? I say to Donald Trump that you cannot change us. We will change you.
What about Britain?
Britain, you know, it is an old tiger that cannot do anything because we see that he has his own problem, unfortunately. And Australia...
You're not talking about Brexit, are you?
Yeah, of course. Brexit has affected so much. Great Britain is like a lion, that she is very much old.
Donald Trump has said the reason he pulled out of the deal is that it was too generous, that it gave Iran free rein to meddle in the Middle East. As far as Washington is concerned, Iran is run by a hardline Islamic regime that wants to dominate the region and develop nuclear weapons. Now, Iran has always denied that. But many Iranians believe that the West has never understood their country. That yes, there are conservatives, but there are also liberals as well. Well, this is incredible, to be at a pop concert in Tehran. There's hundreds of people in the audience here. They're all seated and all of the women are wearing their headscarves. There are ushers keeping a careful eye in the audience. Nobody is allowed to stand up and dance. But that doesn't mean people can't sway in their seats. Some of them have glow sticks and many of them are singing the lyrics of one of Iran's biggest pop stars. People here want to have a good time.
My name is Hossein Tutunchian. I'm manager of IranConcert.com.
Is pop music liberal?
Yeah. Yeah, why not? We adapt ourselves. This is not too hard. At the first time, you think that it might be very hard and dangerous. But nowadays, after a few years, we understand how we can adapt ourselves with the Islamic rules, with the artistics.
Who are the Western acts that you love? Who would you love to promote in Iran?
In Iran? Yeah. I really like to promote the few singers that they're not allowed to hold a concert in Iran. I'm a fan of Celine Dion. She's brilliant. And also Whitney Houston.
We're sitting out in the street under a green umbrella in a lovely cafe. Young people in their 20s and 30s. It's a liberal place.
I've seen one woman not wearing a headscarf. And that's perhaps to be expected because we're in northern Tehran, which is the wealthy, middle-class area of the city. A gentleman's just coming over. I think he wants to have a word.
My name is Mohammed.
How worried are you about what's happening between America and Iran? Are you concerned about the situation?
History says that it's too hard to trust Americans. Because whenever Iranians trust America, they've just shown something else. Atomic bombs. Okay, atomic bombs definitely is not a good idea. But who is the only and the first country who has used it?
How much has Iran changed since you were a teenager?
Definitely, Iran is changing. The young generations have a huge tendency for being modernized, for being westernized, and they are trying to adapt themselves with what is happening in the world. And you can see that in the atmosphere of the society.
Chants of death to America outside a mosque. Make no mistake, it's the hardliners that run this country. But when Iran is confronted by America, both conservatives and liberals here will always put their country first.
That report was by Martin Patience in Iran. Still to come in this podcast.
Okay, knees up in front, arms moving too, and then arms up above.
Research suggests that exercise and a healthy lifestyle can lower the risk of dementia for nearly everyone, even if it runs in your family. The United Nations has called for the dismantling of all refugee detention centres in Libya, saying the facilities are not fit to house migrants. The appeal comes 2 weeks after more than 50 people were killed by an airstrike on a holding facility in the capital Tripoli. Our Middle East analyst, Alan Johnston, reports.
Thousands of refugees and migrants are being held in Libyan detention centres. They often endure dire conditions, crammed into converted warehouses. Some are close to the front lines in the ongoing battle for control of Tripoli. They're in real danger, as the recent devastating airstrike on one centre revealed. The UN's refugee agency is calling for urgent action. Vincent Cochetel is a special envoy.
We believe those detention centres should immediately close. People should move out of those places. And we could have a system of release in the community where we can assist the people in urban areas. There are other solutions than just putting people in detention in an arbitrary manner for an indefinite period of time.
The UN says the European Union's institutions also want the detention facilities to be closed, but it suggested that some EU member states perhaps see the centres as a necessary part of the effort to stem the flow of migrants. Those countries weren't named, but Italy has taken the hardest line in this sort of area. It says migrants should be intercepted at sea by Libyan coast guards and taken back to Libya. But the UN says the country just isn't safe enough for returning migrants.
Alan Johnston there. Now, another reason, should you need it, to embrace a healthy lifestyle. Research suggests that doing so can lower the risk of dementia for nearly everyone, even if it runs in your family. The study, presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, followed nearly 200,000 people. It showed that the rate of dementia fell by a third in those who looked after their health. Our health and science correspondent James Gallagher has been looking at the findings.
OK, knees up in front, arms moving too, and then arms up above.
An exercise class is just one way to help reduce the risk of dementia. The study also linked not smoking, drinking only in moderation, and a healthy, balanced diet to a lower risk of the disease. This applied even to people whose DNA meant they were born with a much higher genetic risk of the disease. The researchers at the University of Exeter said the findings were exciting, empowering, and that people shouldn't feel they were doomed to get dementia. As researcher David Llewellyn explains.
Even if you're worried about dementia, maybe you've got a family history of dementia yourself, what our research suggests is that it doesn't matter, you're still likely to reduce your own risk of dementia substantially if you change your healthy lifestyle.
However, you can live the life of a saint and still get the disease. Lifestyle just changes the odds. Less than 1% of people in the study developed dementia as they were relatively young and in their mid-60s. But living a healthy lifestyle cut their risk by a third.
That was James Gallagher. Now, you might not be familiar with the name Lucy Walker, but she was a pioneering mountaineer in the 19th century. Now, a new play, High in the Alps, is reliving her struggle for equality and her historic victory over men and mountains. Imogen Folks reports from Zermatt in Switzerland.
On a beautiful summer evening in the shadow of the world's most iconic mountain, the Matterhorn, a little-known episode in history is being reenacted.
My name is Livia Ann Richard, and I'm the director of Matterhorn No Ladies, Please. The basic story is about Lucy Walker, the first woman of the world on the summit of the Matterhorn. That was in a time when it was forbidden to women to do any sport at all.
Backstage, actress Corinne Tallman, who plays Lucy, is struggling into her costume.
It's like three layers of skirt. I don't even do my warm-up in those clothes because they're too tight and it's not comfortable. I think if you climb the Matterhorn with a skirt and with no sunglasses, you must be really brave, a little crazy maybe. I mean, I don't know how she did that.
Are you by any chance laughing at me, Frederick?
But clothes were just one of many obstacles Lucy faced, explains climber and filmmaker Caroline Fink.
Being a woman, she had to break social conventional challenges, because back then, of course, a lady was not supposed to get sunburned. A lady was not supposed to climb mountains in the company of guys maybe she didn't even know well. I mean, she must have been a very strong woman and a very ambitious woman.
I can climb as well as my brother, and you know...
Strong and ambitious indeed, Lucy Walker had already climbed the Eiger, and in August 1871, she reached the summit of the Matterhorn, just 6 years after Edward Whymper, the first man to do so. But despite Lucy's achievement, says Livia Ann Richard, little is known about her.
It was quite hard to research this play because women were not allowed to publish either that time. So when you go Google Lucy Walker, there's not much. When you Google Edward Whymper, you will find a huge amount of articles and a bunch of books.
Lucy Walker never got the recognition she deserved. She was even denied entry to the British Alpine Club. But over the years, dozens of women have followed in her footsteps, among them Eveline Binsack, who became the first Swiss woman to climb Mount Everest.
You look around, 360 degrees, and all the other mountains are smaller. It's just such a great feeling to be up there, to be the first woman from Switzerland on a mountain. It was like, no man can take this away from me. Wow, now I can do something in the mountains no man can talk or interrupt.
But, says Caroline Fink, there is still work to do, and she hopes this new play about Lucy Walker's life will inspire even more women to believe that they too can stand on top of the world.
There has never been a female instructor, for example, in mountain guide training in Switzerland, and there are close to 1,300 mountain guides, male mountain guides, working in Switzerland, and 38 women. So we see that there's still a big gap. And by showing the pioneers, the female pioneers, that were strong, proud, ambitious women, I think we can send a message to the younger women today that, hey, if you have the passion to climb mountains, just go for it.
Caroline Fink ending that report from Imogen Folks in Switzerland. And from Switzerland to Wimbledon, and Novak Djokovic won a gripping men's singles tennis final on Sunday, beating Roger Federer in a battle lasting 5 sets and almost 5 hours, a record for the tournament. The match was decided by an historic tiebreak after Federer had twice pegged back his rival. It's the 5th Wimbledon title for Djokovic and his 16th Grand Slam win. Just minutes after the pretty epic match finished on centre court, we heard from our sports correspondent, Dilip Lloyd.
Pretty epic is an understatement. Novak Djokovic, the defending champion and world number one, has won this 2019 men's final by beating Roger Federer, the 8-time champion here at Wimbledon, in an incredible match that spanned 4 hours and 57 minutes, and it went into a deciding set tiebreak. New rules this year at the championships, where Wimbledon, the All England Club, had decided that if we go into a fifth set, at 12-all, it will be a tiebreak, and Djokovic has taken it 13-12, winning that tiebreak right at the death. And it has to be said, an absolutely epic final of enormous proportions. Two players going toe-to-toe, fantastic tennis. Djokovic winning the first set on a tiebreak. Federer taking the second 6-1. Djokovic winning the third set on a tiebreak. Federer then winning the fourth 6-4. And we've just witnessed incredible scenes on centre court. An epic tiebreak, and Djokovic finally taking it from Federer. Federer, however, had 2 championship points in that fifth set at 8-7. He was serving for the set, but he couldn't make those points count, and how he will rue those, because Novak Djokovic has won today. He's won a 5th Wimbledon title to equal that record of the legend of Bjorn Borg.
There was so much love, it has to be said, in the stadium, in the audience, for Roger Federer. He's an incredibly popular player. That must make it hard for Djokovic.
It certainly does, and it's probably something that does rankle a little bit with Novak Djokovic. Roger Federer, loved across the world. He's the icon of tennis. He's won 20 Grand Slam finals. He was aiming for a 21st today, but Novak Djokovic has always been hot on his heels, hot on the heels of Rafa Nadal as well, who Federer beat in Friday's semi-final. And Novak Djokovic now has won 16 Grand Slam titles. A lot of debate about who's the biggest player, greatest player of all time. We'll soon find out in years to come. Come when they all retire.
It's got to be said that there were lots of gasps around the newsroom as this game was going on. In your assessment, Delith, how does this rate among final games?
I think you have to probably now call this arguably the best Wimbledon men's final of all time. I think up until recently, a lot of people perhaps felt it was the 2008 final that Nadal beat Federer when we were going right into the evening and it was dark and there was camera flashes going off. We could barely see the ball. That final from 11 years ago up until now was perhaps classed as the most epic Wimbledon of men's finals. But today has certainly challenged that, because you've got 2 former world number ones, 2 great players, Roger Federer knocking on 38, arguably the greatest of all time, but Djokovic just superb in beating him.
That was Dilip Lloyd in Wimbledon. And staying with sport, the England men's team have won their first ever Cricket World Cup, beating New Zealand at Lord's in one of the most thrilling matches ever. Yes, really. The two teams were level at the end of normal play, having both scored 241 runs. A super over was also tied, but England claimed the title, having scored more boundaries. From outside the ground, John Watson reports.
Who would have thought after 7 weeks of cricket we would find this decided on a super over? England will feel pleased, setting New Zealand that target of 16 runs for victory. 15 was all that New Zealand could produce in reply from that final over. And you can probably hear the fireworks going off behind me as England win this tournament for the very first time. No one would have ever imagined that it would have come down and been decided in this way. A fantastic tournament rounded off with a brilliant end, with England lifting the World Cup in such dramatic scenes.
And who could have imagined that? That was John Watson outside Lord's Cricket Ground in London. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Now, just before I go, I want to remind you, should you need reminding, that in just 5 days, it will be exactly 50 years since Neil Armstrong first walked on the moon.
I'm going to step off the land now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I think we're going to be playing that a few times in the next few days. However, we are marking the occasion here on the BBC World Service with a detailed examination of the events that led up to that moment. And the Global News podcast is in some ways also going into space. I will be recording a special moon landing podcast on Saturday, the 20th of July, and I would love to hear from you. So if you have any memories or anecdotes about the moon landings, get in touch. Were you watching? Were you inspired? Did the achievement of the moon landings change your ambitions or the way you looked at the universe? You know, big stuff, small stuff. I would love to hear from you. Our email is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
That's me drinking millions of viruses.
Crowd Science is the podcast that takes your questions and turns them into audio adventures.
My question for Crowd Science is, why and when did humans first start cooking food?
It's all fire!
I'm Marnie Chesterton, and each week we put your questions to scientists working at the limits of human knowledge.
I wanted to know how cells... how do they know what to do?
They're yanking on their neighbours, they're pushing on their neighbours.
We also try and demonstrate exactly what they're telling us.
What are the limits of human endurance?
You've just run a marathon and been hit by a car. How are you?
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
So if you'd like to inject a bit more science into that...
just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew it! Amazing!